Previously on Beta.
This child is trying to sell me the Brooklyn Bridge.
We're about to head into what we think is one of the creepiest places we've ever seen.
You know, not even misperceptions, they're just wrong.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, the Mountain Goats singer-songwriter John Darnielle. He also moonlights as a novelist. John joins us to talk about his haunting book, Devil House. It's a propulsive thriller about a true crime author who moves into a house where two murders happened.
All that ties into the fact that folklore and urban legend play into a lot of the themes in this, the things people think they know about things. The Satanic Panic was a case where a lot of people thought they knew a lot about stuff they didn't actually know about.
Also, Rise co-author Jeff Yang. He shares the growth, setbacks, and hopes from the past 30 years of Asian American pop culture.
We are kind of defiantly Asian American in some cases, certainly resiliently Asian American. But most importantly, we no longer feel quite the same need to explain ourselves.
But first, singer-songwriter Anais Mitchell. NPR says that she's one of the greatest songwriters of her generation. Her latest self-titled solo album offers proof that this is indeed the case. It's Anais' seventh solo album and her first since 2012. Why the delay? Because she was busy creating her hit musical, Hadestown. It won 8 Tony Awards and a Grammy. When the pandemic hit in 2020, Anais was 9 months pregnant. She and her family left New York to return to her home state of Vermont. Anais wrote the songs for the album in her grandparents' old house. Her Bonnie Light Horseman bandmate, Josh Kaufman, produced the album. Beta's resident music correspondent, Steve Gotcher, sat down to talk with Anais.
The music on this record has an overall positive feel, and I love how the album starts out on the Brooklyn Bridge. It's hopeful and it's forward-looking. Why did you want to open the record with this song?
You know, there's something about the recording, I think. We recorded this whole record in the Hudson Valley. My bandmate Josh Kaufman is the producer of it, and we had our friends JT Bates and Mike Lewis, who actually came from the Twin Cities. And we were there in the room together. You know, we also had Thomas Bartlett, who was playing piano. He had come up from the city. And it was so remarkable to actually be able to share airspace together and record this music live. And you can hear all of that at the beginning of the track. Like, I think someone makes like a heavy sigh and then someone counts off the drums and then kind of doesn't play. And I just loved that you could hear the humans in the room at the beginning of that track. And then, of course, the track itself, it felt like it was a portal. It was a sort of an entryway into the record.
Over Brooklyn Bridge in a taxi. Over Brooklyn Bridge, you and me in the backseat. Finally got you by my side. Riding high. Brooklyn Bridge through the arches. Over Brooklyn Bridge, you and me in the darkness. I wanna take you by the hand.
It's a remembrance for me of a really romantic feeling that I've always had about New York City, where I lived for 7 years and which I sort of abandoned in a rush in the pandemic to have my second kid, and I ended up staying in my home state of Vermont. So I was really missing New York, and it just felt like the kind of longing that wanted to start this record out.
Yeah. You mentioned that you left New York City for Vermont, and you moved your family to your grandparents' home on a Vermont farm. Why did you want to make such a radical change like that?
It was completely unplanned. You know, it was literally, I was 9 months pregnant when the pandemic reached New York City, and it was one day to the next. You know, I pulled my older kid out of school one day, and the next day We didn't have a car. We had given up our car because we lived in New York and didn't need one. And I was like, I think we need to get a car in case we need an escape vehicle. And then the day after that, Broadway shut down and we just packed up the car and drove to Vermont. It wasn't the plan. And there was a brief moment of angst about it, like we had left behind so much in New York. But then very quickly was like, oh, wow, what a gift, you know, for us. And I know that there's irony in the fact that, like, this time that was so traumatic for so many people, the flip side of that coin was it was very healing for a lot of other people, and that was true for me, to just to unplug from our lives in New York and to reconnect with my childhood, the place I grew up, my family, the natural world, and ultimately, like, myself and my inspiration. It was really, really healing for me.
Now, on the song Now You Know, it's a great piece of writing that moves from one idea to another, kind of the way thoughts move seemingly at random through one's head and then returns back to where it started. What can you tell me about this tune? It's really a wonderful piece of writing.
Thank you so much. You know, this is actually the one song on the record that I didn't write during the pandemic. It predates the album by years, actually, and I wrote it before I had kids. But there was something about it that it felt like it really belonged with these other songs, and it's a song about growing up, really. It's a song about my kind of life love partner and all the feelings that are bound up in that person that you love, and especially the sense of your own mortality, you know, that is connected to your life partner. That feeling of you're growing older with someone, you're watching them age, and a sort of acceptance of that.
When I think about dying, I think about children. And when I think about children, I think about you. And when I think about you, I feel like crying. Crying for my youth.
How much did the pandemic have an influence on the writing of this album?
I mean, I think it had a tremendous influence, but it's not that I was writing about the pandemic in any way. Right. It was the fact that the pandemic forced me to leave behind my whole context in New York and to go home and to have this really like sense of return, sense of full circleness, and also the space and the time to the stillness, you know, to really reconnect with what my own voice is, or what, you know, what the muse is for me.
Yeah, still a lot of records I've heard that were written under the influence of the pandemic have a melancholy and some sense of slight hopelessness in it. But this record overall has a real sense of purpose and hope.
I love that you say that. You know, I feel like there's a bittersweetness to a lot of the songs. But you're right. And I think actually there's something about the age I am now that I'm really like, I'm really enjoying the major keys in a way that I might not have. When I was younger, I thought, you know, I loved the minor keys and the sort of mining of the darkness. I found that much more compelling. And now I find compelling the sort of exploration of like the delight, the wonder of the world, the wonder that it is to be alive, you know. And maybe part of that is being a mom and seeing the world through my kids' eyes, seeing that world with that childlike kind of wonder again, and sort of re-experiencing that myself.
Oh, okay. Now, the record has a lush sparseness, if I can say that, and it shows a lot of restraint, and the arrangements really complement the lyrics very well. Now, you worked with Josh Kaufman, your colleague from Bonnie Light Horseman. He produced the record. Tell me about what it was like working together.
Yeah. You know, I had had an experience of working with Josh previously because he produced our Bonnie Light Horseman record. And we've actually since made a second one, which he also produced. I mean, he's incredible, really incredible set of ears. He's a warm person, and he creates a feeling of warmth, I think, in his sessions, and really of acceptance of people, where I think he's able to allow people to be just who they are and in that way get the best from them. He's also like, he's very focused all the time. He's chasing down, you know, the track, the song, the take. But he also, the feeling is that we're just hanging out, you know?
Yeah.
There's not a sort of grim sense of duty, really. And I think that you're right, that it was really important to him that the storytelling on this record be the kind of engine of the music, and that he wanted to create a a lush and warm sort of environment for those stories to be told in, but he didn't really want to compete with the melodic line of the voice with other instruments. So yeah, I think that was kind of a guiding star for him.
Now, the song On Your Way, Felix song, seems to be using the studio experience as kind of a metaphor about life, and I love the lyric.
I remember when your tape was rolling, you were going where the tape was going. No regrets and no mistakes, you get one take, you're on your way.
What can you tell me about this song?
Yeah, it's a remembrance of this friend of mine who died in the summer of 2020. Not of COVID, but similarly, it was unexpected, and he was young, he was in his 40s. It felt like there was no way to, you know, no one could gather and like mourn the loss of this person, this songwriter. And so the song was sort of a me processing the fact that he was no longer in the world. And Felix is a songwriter that I came up with in my young days. We had the same manager briefly, and he, incredible songwriter. He always had a guitar strapped on him. He would, you know, he'd show up at a party, at the bar, he would have the guitar on him. And his ethos really in life and in creativity was like to just rush at the thing, just rush at the moment. If you're talking about writing a song, just do it now. Let's do it now. And he actually is one of the first people I met that he was doing this practice of writing a song a day for a certain amount of time. He wrote 50 songs in 50 days and he made this album out of it. And this is when I was first getting started as a songwriter. And I was like, I could never do that. That's not how I roll. But I admired that that's how he made music. And there's something about that, just not overthinking of it, that it was like, you get access to something if you're just trusting, trusting the take. And when I think about it, it's like, he couldn't have known that he wasn't going to have as many years as most of us hope to have, but I don't think he'd have done it differently, you know? He didn't have time to overthink things, and he didn't overthink them. You know, he went for it all the time.
Joni Mitchell wrote songs that were very personal and very revealing, and some thought that she showed a little too much of herself, but I think it also was an element that made her songs so very powerful. Do you find that kind of power in your writing by revealing parts of yourself through your music?
You know, this is definitely the most personal and kind of direct record I've ever made. Obviously, Hadestown was this like grand experiment in taking on the voices of other characters, sort of dressing up in these larger than life voices. But that's also something that I did on earlier songwriter records. I would kind of like take on these characters like Young Man in America and sort of dress up in a disguise. And these songs on this record are not that. There's no disguise. They're almost embarrassingly direct, you know, at times. And I think for me, like, what I'm interested in is the sort of intersection of what feels like really honest, almost like how honest can I be? And that place in me that feels really sort of vulnerable, like feel like in my body, like I want to cry.
Yeah.
But then also feels like it's something that could be mythic. It could be somebody else's experience. It could be universal, you know, that could be a million people have had that experience of riding over the Brooklyn Bridge in New York, you know, and it's like to hit that like Venn diagram of what feels really intensely personal and also intensely universal, that's where I would like to live as a songwriter.
When you get that close and when you're writing a song, how do you know that what you're conveying is honest and not some kind of a construct that's presenting yourself in a way that you really aren't?
Mm-hmm. It's like, it's physiological for me. I feel if I'm writing the song and the line comes along, yeah, a lot of times I'll cry. I do cry a lot writing. I cry so much writing the song that I'll never cry again singing it. You know what I mean? It's like all the tears have been shed in the writing of it. And there's a way in which I feel it in my body if it's honest. And some songs, like that song Little Big Girl, it took years to finish it because I could not figure out how to say it in a way that was honest. I started that song in 2016. The first verse kind of dropped out into my lap and I felt like, oh, this is real. This is an important song for me to write. And then I kept trying over the years to write it, and it felt like it kept veering towards something that was something like a feminist anthem, you know, or like me on a soapbox telling it like it is, as if I had everything figured out. And ultimately, it just, it wasn't true, because the truth was I didn't have it all figured out, you know. And in fact, the song is about a woman not having it all figured out and sort of seeing her mom and seeing that her mom didn't have it all figured out either. When I finally discovered what that was, I just felt it in my body. Like, this is what I'm trying to say.
Is it frustrating to take that long to write a song?
Oh my God, so frustrating. I mean, I want to quit, you know? but thankfully, it's not always like that. Sometimes it flows, and that makes it all worth it.
Now, you close the album with the song Watershed. Tell me what inspired the song, and who are you singing it to?
Yeah, the watershed is, I mean, obviously a metaphor, but also it's a literal place for me. That word shows up in another song on the record called Backroads, because during the pandemic summer, I was doing a lot of hiking. And there's a hiking area near my high school, and I went with my high school boyfriend. We would like lay on a blanket in a field and read poetry. And it was, I actually couldn't remember the name of the place. And I texted my high school boyfriend, what is the name of this place we used to go? And he says, it's called the Watershed. It's called the Bristol Watershed. So I went there with my family, and I hiked around and just kept turning that word over in my mind and finding it so beautiful, because I realized, like, I was at a watershed in my life. I felt that I was at a moment of clarity, like a vista, that for years I had been kind of in the woods, like with my head down, putting one foot in front of the other, you know, trying to finish Hadestown, trying to be a mom. Suddenly I could see again. It was as if I came to the top of one little mountain peak, and I could see behind me and I could see ahead of me. And that's what that song is about. It's about those moments.
Nobody gives you a map of the ridge. You climb one mountain and you find the next. Follow the river to the fountainhead, watershed. The tallest summit you look up to, someday it's gonna look small to you. There's a new one coming into view, and you'll climb that too, but before you do, you get time to stand looking off the ledge, where the rivers branch to the east and the west, and to catch your breath at the sight of it. The heights on which your heart was set, that you won so hard and then lost so fast, are now somehow just silhouettes. You stop and bend in the light that's left, and you cup your hands in the riverbed.
And I also will say, my friend showed up on my doorstep, and he had just had his like life partnership implode. And it was this type of couple that you know, you don't mention one name without the other. And I couldn't believe that this relationship had ended, but it had. And so he came really raw with that experience, and there's a way in which I was writing that song for him. We hiked at the watershed together, and I was thinking about that idea of, you know, the things you strive so hard for. And for me, it was Hadestown, I guess, you know, and for him it was like this marriage, and just, you know, you shed so much, you shed so many tears, you there's so much love and effort and sweat that goes into a thing, and then it's like it's gone, it's up in smoke, and there you are. And that feeling of almost grace that happens in those times of loss, where it's like, and I'm still here, you know, and I'm gonna carry that experience with me forward on my path. There's also, I think, embedded in that word watershed, the idea of the shedding of tears, and the way that we sort of have to cry so much in these moments of transition to kind of ease the passageway, like wash in the transition on a wave of tears, you know, a birth, a death, a graduation, any of these ritual moments of transition.
Anais Mitchell, congratulations on your fine new album, and thanks for taking the time to join us today. It's
Thank
a real
you.
Pleasure to talk to you. Thanks.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Singer-songwriter Anais Mitchell on her self-titled solo album. It's her first new album in a decade. She talked to Steve Gotcher. Find out more about Anais and her music at wpr.org/beta.
You know, when you're a child, at some point you think, wow, somebody lived here before we did. It's a very profound moment, you know, when you're a kid.
Coming up, the Mountain Goats singer-songwriter John Darnielle talks about his novel, Devil House. You're listening to Beta From Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Doug Gordon. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Ideally, you leave as little footprint as possible when you're telling a true crime story. Your job is to gather the facts of a case and arrange them as vividly as possible. Somebody else has already done all the dirty work for you. Arm yourself with some steady work habits and a well-lit workspace, and there's really nothing to it, just the simple pleasures of research, footwork, and presentation. It's like being a florist. You ask a few questions about the occasion you're being asked to mark, and then you hide your own signature somewhere in the arrangement.
That's John Darnielle reading an excerpt from his novel, Devil House. It's the story of a true crime writer named Gage Chandler, who's working on a new book. Gage actually moves into the house where the grisly murders that he's writing about happened. It's John's third novel. His debut, Wolf in White Van, was a nominee for the National Book Award for Fiction. When John is not writing novels, he's writing and performing songs for the Mountain Goats. Rolling Stone has described him as the best storyteller in rock. John's fans once launched a petition to name him the United States Poet Laureate. I would have voted for him. John joined us from his home in Durham, North Carolina, to talk about Devil House.
I don't really mark the moment of what makes me want to write something, except that I did hear about this thing called Castle Doctrine that's used a lot by gun groups to justify shooting people who, to justify shooting people, but very interested in the name Castle Doctrine, right? So I looked into it and I thought about castles. I thought a lot about castles. I said, well, if I was going to write a book, maybe I'll have a guy who's supposed to be descended from kings. What could happen there? So I had some crime ideas in my head and I had some castle ideas in my head. And then I just started going.
Mm. And I've read that there was you live in Durham, North Carolina, and that there was this building with this homemade sign that kind of intrigued you?
That's right. That's a big part of it. It was called Monster Triple X. It was a brick building that's gone now across the street from Golden Belt, which is a former hosiery mill that had been converted to offices and now is converted to condos like everything else around here. We got thrown out. I did, and the really wonderful organization down the hall from me, Youth Build, we got told that they were going to retrofit the building for condominiums. So we had to leave, and this was sort of a later version of what had happened to the building across the street, which was a strip of brick buildings that had been there since probably the late 1800s. But they were in a state of decay, and one of them at one point for like a week, I happened to drive past it, and there was a hand-painted sign out front that said Monster Triple X DVDs, and it looked so homemade. It looked like something from a different universe, and I sort of bonded about it with Christina at Merge, the publicist at Merge, was like, oh, did you see Monster Triple X? It's like everything these days is laser printed, but this was hand painted, and it was sort of darkly inspiring in that way. And then it was gone. I saw it once.
Mm-hmm. Your protagonist is a true crime writer named Gage Chandler. One day his editor emails him a news clipping. Can you tell us about that news clipping?
The clipping is a very small incidental notice. It's actually it'd be a photo stat of some microfiche. He says that somebody was going through something for another project and ran across a story about a crime scene where there'd been a couple of bodies and what appeared to be some satanic or cultic decorations on the scene inside a porn store in Milpitas, California. So he sends this to his writer and says, hey, this looks like this building is up for sale. I looked into it. This looks like your thing, because he has this method acting way of writing where he gets inside a property.
I was really intrigued by your writing style in the early part of the book where you're describing the history of the Devil House. You convey this really strong, really powerful sense of place. Why did you devote so much cognitive bandwidth to this part of the novel?
I sort of feel like, every place is so distinctive that you don't really know anything about it unless you've been there. I sort of always felt this way, and then the feeling became much stronger after I lived in Iowa for 7 or 8 years. And you hear people talk about Iowa, and you say, wow, you don't know anything about what it's like here. You've seen Field of Dreams, and that's about it. Or you watch the caucuses every 4 years, and then they do some local color interviews. And it sort of shored up in me that if you're trying to sketch a picture of a place, you should give as complete a feeling of it as you can. And I think that starts with history. Like, how did this place come to be populated by immigrants, almost always, if you're talking about the U.S., or most, if you're not native to the country, then your people immigrated at some point. And how did they get there? In California, there's a general story of the westward movement, but every place in California has its own version of that, has its own story. And in the case of places outside of San Francisco, these are post-gold rush places that then become industrial centers. And in the case of Milpitas, become tech centers, right? And so I was interested in that. I sort of think it helps bring people inside a place because these stories are relatable once you dig deep enough into them.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that helps in the case of Devil House is that it's had these different lives. Like it started out as a diner, then it becomes a newsstand, then it ends up as a porn store and a video store.
I think every building has a story like that if it's got any age at all, right? I think this is something I've been thinking about since I was a kid. You know, when you're a child, if you... At some point, you think, "Wow, somebody lived here before we did." It's a very profound moment, you know, when you're a kid. And I moved to the South from the West Coast, where a lot of places are only, you know, 100 years old or less, where I grew up. But out here, like, there's buildings that are still having new lives 150, 200 years down the line. You know, that's pretty interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was it about the Satanic Panic of the 1980s that made you want to include it in the book?
For one thing, I worked in mental health late 80s, most of the 90s, and the early 2000s. I was working in mental health, and I was there. I was at ground level for the Satanic Panic, working on children's and adolescents units. So I had these adolescent characters who I was going to have marking the porn store in some way to scare off people, well, not to scare them off, but to freak out people who happened across it. And that sort of seemed like an obvious route in. The devil as a trope, I'm hardly the first writer to be kind of drawn to that, right? So it's like, I have some esoteric ideas. I'm into Christianity, but the devil is John Milton. The devil is a very post-medieval notion, or at least medieval. And so I like to think about sort of the power it has totemically, these ideas of radical, outreaching evil. And also it has to do with, all that ties into the fact that folklore and urban legend play into a lot of the themes in this, the things people think they know about things. The Satanic Panic was a case where a lot of people thought they knew a lot about stuff they didn't actually know about.
You have a section in the book that explores Gage's previous book. It's told in the second person. Can you tell us about it?
This is Gage Chandler's first book, the one that they made a movie out of, so he got a little action off that. Gage talks in part one about, if you're going to write in a genre that's kind of crowded, you want to be able to distinguish yourself in some way. And stylistically, he's got a little something different going, right? He writes in the second person, which has a pretty interesting effect. So yeah, it's a story that takes place in Morro Bay, which was a town near San Luis Obispo where I was a kid. This Central California area, it really looks like the Mediterranean. It's gorgeous. And it's a story of self-defense, which is what Castle Doctrine is purportedly all about, right? It's like that you should be able to defend your home against invaders, right? Now, again, this is a legal precept that is often deployed in some pretty nefarious circumstances. But in the case of the White Witch, she gets life, or the chair. I can't remember. I do remember researching this and going, wait, it's California, and they outlawed capital punishment in California in after Carol Chessman, who was 69, so she can't get the chair, right? I remember doing that research. So, but yeah, so that's what it's about. It's about a school teacher who defends herself against a couple of invaders.
Mm-hmm. One of the most powerful parts of Devil House is when Jana Perez, the mother of one of Diana Crane's victims, writes a letter to Gage. Can you tell us about this letter?
Structurally, I was looking for a solution to the fact that I wanted this book to have this mirror structure. So parts 1 and 7 are in the first person, parts 2 and 6 are in the second person, parts 3 and 5 are in the third, and then the fourth part is discrete. It's its own thing and stands alone. But when I got to part 5, I didn't want to just really continue the book we'd already been looking at in part 2. So I thought, how else could we write in the second person? And that's when I got the idea of addressing. It's still narrated by Gage, but he's describing the letter he was sent and responding and saying, you said this to me. But it's by the mother of one of Diana Crane's victims. You usually don't call the victims of a self-defense killing victims, but that's who they are to their mothers and fathers. So that's what it is. It's an attempt to broaden the scope of the telling of a story, because when we tell a story where somebody gets seriously hurt or killed, and really any story, questions of perspective loom, and we usually, almost every story winds up being narrowed to only include one perspective, with maybe a nod toward the possibility of other perspectives, but I wanted to burrow a little deeper and see if we could understand how stories like these affect sort of the incidental people in their tellings.
Yeah, and Jenna is really mad at Gage for what he wrote about her son. To me, this raises a lot of questions about the ethics of writing true crime. Do you think true crime writers are exploiting victims for their own gain?
Well, I mean, yes. At the same time, that's not to say people shouldn't write these books. I'm more looking at, I mean, it's a broader question than just true crime. That's the specific case of what I'm talking about. But I think all writing, even fiction writing, is to some extent open to charges of having left out important perspectives. But that sounds pretty sterile to say it that way. I mean, who cares? You left out some perspectives, right? So, but if you look at it in a specific case, if someone's saying, look, this harmed me, this made something bad worse for me, then that fairly sterile point about writing becomes vivid. So it's the case in true crime. It's the case in biography. It's the case in autobiography. And, you know, it's the case in the news that when you tell a story, you are only including some of the perspective most likely. And of course, there's no cure for that. You can't sort of both sides something to until you have no story. That's impossible, right? But at the same time, if anything, it's a call for care, for taking care and being aware, for reading one's own work and seeing what you maybe didn't notice you were saying and so forth. And it's important in true crime. But I do want to say the book is not so much a critique of true crime as more about the weight of writing, of its specific weight on real people out in the world.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Very well said. Yes. Besides your career as a novelist, you also have a career as the main member of the Mountain Goats. So I'm curious, how do your novels influence your songwriting, and how does your songwriting influence your novels?
I don't know that they do. I think anything I write, anything anybody writes, comes from a sort of a river inside or an electrical current, like a broad picture, not a thin current, but a broad stream of current, you know, and it can assume various forms. But the actual impulse is more raw than that. It doesn't have words. It doesn't have melody. It's a mood. Picking a form for it is almost arbitrary. You know, I think I do tend to look at bigger, more open-ended questions in books and in songs. In songs, you're looking for the way the melody can wrap around the words in a way that makes them maximally effective. You know, you don't have the leisure that you have in a novel. So while they are part of a creative continuum, I'm not sort of like borrowing things from one realm to put into the other. They're discrete in that way.
Mm-hmm. But correct me if I'm wrong on this, John, but also a lot of your songs are kind of story-based and feature characters. So does a character that ever starts in a song, they
Yes.
always stay in a song? They don't make it to a novel?
No. There's a bunch of reasons I wouldn't do that. I mean, for one thing, with characters in books, you really have to... Part of the point is to make them very vivid. So you are
right.
Telling the reader what they are supposed to see. And there's a lot of play you can do with that, right? You can tell the reader what they're supposed to see and then yank the rug out from under them later, right? When something new is revealed, right? But with characters and songs, they're sketches. So even when you have a lot of good detail, a character in a song is somebody that the reader or listener is going to bring more of themselves to, right? They are very different in that way. That a character in a book, you are trying to put as much meat on their bones as you can, right? You're trying to show somebody, and Dickens is sort of like the master of this, right? That like when Dickens paints a character, then we all see the same thing. You know, we really get a feel for Martin Chuzzlewit or whoever, you know. But in songs, you find that people all have their own feeling for a character. Maybe a broad subsection of one's audience can bring their own idea to some character and say, look, this is who this person is for us. But music has a subjectivity. I mean, all literature has a subjectivity to it, but the subjectivity of songs is almost radical, that the whole idea of a song is to sound specific, so it doesn't sound like I'm just sort of like saying any old thing and letting you fill in the blanks. But I am saying something loose enough that you can bring your own experience to it and thread the two together. I think in that sense, music is a much more communal and collaborative effort than books are. Reading a book is still a very active process, but the writer has a much bigger job in writing a book in terms of laying out the parameters of what the reader is going to see and feel and hear.
Very well said. John Darnielle, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Devil House and, of course, your work with the Mountain Goats.
Thank you so much. Good to hear from you.
John Darnielle is the author of the novel Devil House, and the singer-songwriter of the Mountain Goats. You can find out more about John at wpr.org/beta.
We are kind of defiantly Asian American in some cases, certainly resiliently Asian American. But most importantly, we no longer feel quite the same need to explain ourselves.
Coming up, Jeff Yang talks about his new book, Rise, which delivers a comprehensive history of Asian Americans through the lens of popular culture. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeff Yang has been covering the Asian American community for more than three decades. He launched one of the very first national magazines that focused on Asian Americans. Now Jeff has taken things to the next level with a book called Rise, A Pop History of Asian America from the 90s to Now. He co-wrote it with his friends Phil Yu and Philip Wong. Journalist Lisa Ling says that Rise made her feel so proud at a moment when so many Asian Americans have been questioning their belonging in America. Jeff tells us why he and his friends decided to write this book.
Looking at the fact that these 30 years in which each of us three grew up, I mean, granted, at different portions of those 30 years, represented something really pivotal in the way that Asian Americans were both depicted in the world, but also the way we saw ourselves. And yet, it's also a portion of our history that has really gone mostly untold and certainly undocumented. And so we first got together to put together the idea for this book under the assumption that it would be sort of like filling in that donut hole, just celebrating all the different ways in which the last three decades have been pivotal to the evolution of our community. And then we had this global pandemic. And with that came this unprecedented wave, it felt, of anti-Asian hostility and xenophobia. And we kind of realized that more than just celebrating what had happened for the last 30 years, we also felt the need to almost put it in a time capsule, like or a hope chest, where if everything were to somehow go away, if all the hard-won success we'd gotten to had started to just shatter under the weight, we would have something to rebuild with. We'd have a blueprint.
Mm, yeah. In 1989, you and some friends created a new publication called A Magazine. Why? Mm.
So I graduated actually that year, and I remember having a very similar moment as the one I had ultimately with Phil and Philip a couple of years ago, where I stood on my bed in my dorm room exhorting these friends of mine to move with me to New York City and try to launch an Asian American magazine, because at the time, magazines were where it was at. If you had a magazine, then you could kind of say your community, your part of the world existed in some fashion, like planting a flag. I mean, back in the 1990s, being Asian American was something people were still a little tentative about. People would say, yes, you know, I'm Asian American. My parents are from name a place in Asia, but I don't really want to call myself an Asian American author, an Asian American performer, an Asian American director, because they were concerned that using that combination, the adjective and the noun, if you will, would limit them in some fashion. It would basically put them in a box from which they could no longer escape. If you're an Asian American writer, you can only write Asian American stuff. And that was something that a lot of people wanted to avoid. Well, I mean, here we are, three decades and change later, and it's no longer something where being Asian American feels like something you have to see as a liability. It's not something that you have to somehow hide. We are kind of defiantly Asian American in some cases, certainly resiliently Asian American. But most importantly, we no longer feel quite the same need to explain ourselves. We can just be sort of Asian American and have that stand for itself. And I think that A Magazine was, in that first decade, looking ahead to a time when being Asian American didn't feel like something you had to constantly explain or apologize for.
Mm-hmm. And it's sad that there was a point when you know, for the longest time you did have to do that, which was just kind of insane that that was the case. You also worked as a TV critic for the Village Voice, and you say that the biggest turning point in your journalism career was a result of this gig. What happened?
All American Girl, which was a television series that ABC developed around Margaret Cho. And Margaret Cho was and is iconic. I mean, she paved the way in so many different ways for Asian American comedy. Basically, Margaret Cho walked so Ali Wong could fly. And so, for that matter, Margaret Cho could fly, because she remains one of the biggest stars in the stand-up comedy pantheon. But back then, she was at the height of her early career, and at the time, ABC and other networks were basically minting sitcoms by taking stand-up comics, their sets, their comedy, their vibe, and then translating them into a half-hour sitcom format. And so they built this show, All American Girl, around her. And I had just been named TV critic at the Village Voice, one of several, but the only one of color and the only one certainly who was Asian American. And my editor asked me to review the first four episodes of this new show, All American Girl.
What do you think your mom would say if she could see us now?
Oh, I know what she'd say. No tongue kissing! No tongue kissing!
Well, guess I better take off.
Thanks for the movie.
That was good, huh? That was weird, though, with all those empty seats, the way that Korean guy sat right next to you.
It was not a good show. It was a show that, more importantly, I thought, really, I think, betrayed Margaret's own comedy herself. She's raw and bawdy and out there and just way over the top. And in this show, she was much more like, she even calls herself Fonzie from Happy Days, as opposed to who she actually is in real life. And I wrote that into the review, honestly, in a pretty acidulous way, right? So the next morning, I got a call, actually, from Margaret. This is the morning, actually, after it published. And she said, I heard you wrote a review of All American Girl. Can you send it to me? And so I faxed it to her, again, another outmoded technology, knowing full well that she was going to flip out. And she did. She called me again right afterward and said, you know, other people warned me about it. I didn't realize how bad and how mean a review was going to be. I'm going to tell you right now, you're one of the only Asian Americans with a TV critic beat. And in fact, you may be the only one with a consistent TV critic beat. When they cancel the show, if they cancel the show, they're going to take this review and throw it on the table and say, even your own community doesn't support this, why should we? And she wasn't entirely wrong, because the show got canceled after 19 episodes. They didn't even really give it a chance to evolve and to shift its focus to align more with Margaret, perhaps. I was reminded of this because years later, Margaret did a one-woman show called I'm the One That I Want, in which an entire section of it, without using my name, was basically about me and what she saw as a betrayal.
I was not wholeheartedly embraced by all of the Korean community. One Korean media action leader decided that I was dangerous and that he would be monitoring my activity and protesting at the first opportunity. I reacted like a Korean Courtney Love. I called him at home in the middle of the night. What the fuck is that? I suppose I could have handled that better.
Again, she wasn't entirely wrong. I felt like after that experience that we were such a fledgling population in terms of where we were in culture, that I didn't want to be in the position of just, you know, doing the thumbs up, thumbs down in that sense. I wanted to amplify and elevate and give people a chance to decide for themselves what they thought was worthy, what they were interested in, because it was so little. And because we as Asian Americans had no room for mediocrity, much less disaster. If we did something wrong, then it would kind of like salt the earth for the next two decades, which is kind of what happened with All American Girl.
You say that the golden age of Hong Kong cinema gave hope to you and other Asian Americans who were coming of age in the 80s and the 90s. How so?
One of the things that was really amazing about Hong Kong cinema as it became this subculture, this fandom-driven underground, is that for the first time, we started to see Asian faces, not just as heroes and villains and love interests and romantic ingenues and slapstick comedians, right? But as everybody. I mean, it was the first time we actually started to see Asian faces across the board. We certainly weren't seeing that in Hollywood. And it made a huge difference because it helped us recognize that we didn't have to actually just be slotted into a single kind of role, the sidekick, the villain, the temptress, right? That we had both the capacity to fill other roles and to do so in a way that would cause heads to spin. Remember, you know, Hong Kong cinema at the time was also just taking huge risks. I mean, real ones, you know, not just narratively, but risks to life and limb. There were people doing things with their bodies.
This is Wu Sheng. That's Hana. Dump them into the sea.
But why?
I said dump them into the sea. Brother. He shows up and you manage to get out of a high security prison? Those two are cops, you idiot! Now kill them both!
What that meant was that for those of us who grew up with these things, who grew up with the original content in language, seen in smoky Chinatown theaters or on much redubbed videotapes, we had an edge. Our friends might be first discovering, oh, this guy Bruce Lee is amazing. Jackie Chan, did you see that? And we'd be like, oh yeah, been there, done that. So it was a twofold thing. On the one hand, it really stretched our own horizons by helping us see the world and ourselves differently, but also it made us cool for the first time.
In 2015, ABC made history with a show called Fresh Off the Boat. It was the first primetime network sitcom about an Asian American family in 20 years. I guess maybe since All American Girl. It also happened to star your son, Hudson Yang, as the lead, Eddie Wong. What do you think Hudson learned about what it means to be an Asian American from being a part of the show?
What's really interesting about Hudson and many of his peers is that the things that we had to actually defend or constantly define or rationalize are things that he sort of takes for granted.
Screw it, I'm out. I've been wanting someone to pass me those dumplings for half an hour, but I don't know how to say give me them dumps in Mandarin.
Mama, woman Ingla.
There are things shown in that show, and that show is set in the 1990s. That show is set in a period of time when I was fully encountering these things in the real world myself, right? But the very first episode has him, as Eddie Wong, bringing his lunch from home to school, right? And his lunch is leftover Chinese food from the day before, which is what I ate like every single day in school. And all the white kids had never seen it before. They said it smells. They mock him and he's forced to eat lunch out back behind the school with the janitor. And it just sort of highlights the fact that being Asian is alienating, or was alienating back in the 1990s. But Hudson has never experienced that. I mean, if he were to bring, when he brought Chinese food to school, all of his friends were like, I want to eat that. I will gladly trade you this meatball hero for your food. You know, kids are eating sushi. You know, it's like the world is so different for him. And so I think for him, it was as much as anything else, a reinforcement of how far we'd come when he played a role that was anchored in such a very different view of an Asian American reality from the one he was actually experiencing.
What is your hope for the future of Asian American representation in pop culture?
I would like to see, more than anything else, the same kind of ease and confidence and ability to sort of stand up and tell stories without having to feel like we need to translate or explain, without a feeling of a need to create a buffer zone culturally around the things that we do and the people that we are, that, you know, really virtually every other community who is part of this larger pop cultural ecosystem, Hollywood and beyond, already can indulge in. What that really means is we have been held to the standard of never being able to be mediocre. And the luxury to be mediocre is something which, more than anything else, is a core part of feeling like you've been accepted in a society. Because not everything is going to be a blockbuster. Not everything is going to be a critical success. But just because you have failed or done middling should not mean that you're exiled to the wilderness forever. And that luxury to be mediocre is perhaps what I wish for most for Asian America.
Yeah, well, let's hope that happens. Jeff Yang, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Rise. It's a great book, very innovative and very important.
Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Jeff Yang is the co-author, along with Phil Yu and Philip Wong, of Rise, a pop history of Asian America from the 90s to now. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Anais Mitchell, John Darnielle, and Jeff Yang. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes, click over to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast catcher and click subscribe, follow, and like. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
He's a Renaissance master of the highest order.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Not now. I'm conducting a job interview.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I have a typographic memory. I recollect the written word with considerable accuracy and detail.